It's Peter Donegan. Andrew Fisher-Tomlin is in my company. You still okay to talk?
Excellent. Yes, I'm okay. I'm just wandering outside so you can get a chance to hear me because the sound in the hall's pretty lousy. But yeah, I'm all good. Yeah, all good.
Well, let's go on past this. We'll hit this button over here, and that is the intro jingle.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
Going to pause it here just for a second, and for you listening at home, I just want to apologize. There's a little bit of wind and noise where Ken is at this moment in time. That's okay. So long as you're okay with this, that's absolutely fine. And we're very grateful also to Adrian and Andrew, who are looking after sound and recording for us today. Ken, you're very welcome to the Sideshow. It's your debut. What took you so long?
Just nobody wants to talk to me. I'm a misunderstood individual.
Well, welcome and meet your sister, Ken. Let me explain this for those of you listening at home, Ken. One of the main reasons I would be aware of you, apart from being extremely good-looking, is what you've paid me to say, but I'm going to leave that one just to one side for a second. You were involved with the APL. You're a good fan of whiskey, apparently, I'm told, so we've got something in common.
Yes, indeed, yes.
But one of the main reasons most of the listeners of the Sideshow might recognise you is in Chelsea 2017... there was a garden that involved Super Shoes. Explain to me a little bit about that, if you can.
Super Shoes is a charity that my wife and I founded. The basis for the charity is to empower children fighting cancer in the UK. And we do that through the gift of bespoke art. So the theory behind this is if you're a 10-year-old lad and you're like Formula One and you're unfortunate enough to be diagnosed with cancer, you're still a 10-year-old lad who's a fan of Formula One. And what tends to happen is that everything about the child becomes the disease. You know, it becomes all about the cancer and not about who they are. So what we do is we provide the children with a gift of bespoke, one-off, hand-painted, customized shoes that paint on the shoes everything that child loves and likes to remind them that they're more than the illness that they face. And to give them that bit of identity back, to sort of say, hey, I am still Tony, and I am a Formula One fan, and not just all about the cancer and bald head and everything that you see. And it's a very, very simple idea, and it's very, very far-reaching. I'm sure if any of us have been given a gift that somebody has made, that means an awful lot more than somebody just going into a shop and buying a gift. So there's lots of people helping children with cancer. This isn't about the cancer itself. This is about the child. And it's about being a small part of that journey and hopefully raising a smile. Yeah, raise a smile and raise some awareness to the lots of the people outside. And that's why we took it to Chelsea, was to raise awareness.
Can I ask you, Ken, if you don't mind me, but what was the catalyst for this light bulb idea, this wonderful, beautiful idea, I should add?
Yeah, well, it was my wife's idea, and she'd seen something similar in the States where there was a lady providing art-related gifts and products to children who were ill. And there was a small child called Henry in Milton Keynes, which is where I live, who had a particularly aggressive form of cancer called neuroblastoma. And there's no relapse protocol for neuroblastoma in the UK, so they have to send them, or certainly there wasn't at that time, there is starting to be now. You had to send them to the States. And this family was trying to raise £500,000, which is an unsurmountable amount of money for most people. And Sarah read about this little boy and saw his page and got hold of the family with the idea that we would like to provide a gift of these shoes that were about Henry, and then get some press, and then, you know, and then that would help raise awareness, which is exactly what we did. And one of our friend's wives was an artist, and she painted, I believe it was Lightning McQueen, Lego, and could have been Lions. I could be wrong in the latter part, but certainly Lego and Lightning McQueen on the shoes. And it went nuts on social media. We had something like 8,000 views in the first day on these shoes, and then we thought, hey, we're really on to something. Sadly, Henry did lose his fight with cancer and passed away, and we still work with the trust for them, who helps us provide shoes for other children fighting cancer. But that was the catalyst. It was a young boy in the village trying to raise a lot of money.
Ken, I want to ask you, and it's a question that comes up irregularly, but while we're on the subject of it, charities that do gardens at Chelsea's and the Hamptons and Tatton's and Cardiff's,
yep.
I'm going to ask you this on a couple of levels, because, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, so I apologise if I say anything incorrect in advance, but your answer is more important than what and how I ask it. But obviously there's a little bit of a money outlay in building a garden, one. Two, some may suggest, well, isn't that money better going off directly to the charity and you don't build a garden? And three, then you go build a garden and you end up with this massive response, and maybe that might change parts or all of question one and two that I've put before that. And again, I double underline this, I apologize for how that's asked, but the answer is hugely important, so we get it crystal clear.
Look, you've hit on one of my biggest bugbears in that there seems to be an assumption, if you're a charitable organization, that spending money on advertising isn't part of the cause. So if I have a business that's looking to make a profit, it's quite all right for me to spend money on advertising and spend my last pound on advertising until it brings in no more revenue. And we seem to have this juxtaposition where if a charity advertises or puts something on the telly or puts a poster or spends money on marketing, that somehow it's not part of the cause, when it's absolutely part of the cause. So I make no bones or no apologies for bringing childhood cancer to such a large audience and spending the money that we did on it. However, on the other side of the picture from that, if a charity spent no money on it, the company that I own now, we paid for the garden. So it didn't cost the charity a penny.
I think there's a thing there as well. It's about you raising awareness of the charity, not necessarily trying to get more money from people, because there's people out there with children with cancer that don't know you exist, and you can do this small thing for them, which is actually has a big result to them. And I know, you know, my experience of working with charities at shows is that, you know, most of the time it's about raising awareness. It's saying we're here. So we did something with Blind Veterans UK last year at Hampton, and they just wanted people to know they were there because they had money to give out, and that's why they put the money into it, and sure enough got £3 million worth of coverage.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just walking away from somebody started a chipper up. I think you put it far more eloquently than ever I could, Andrew, but you're absolutely right. It is about raising the awareness. But at the same time, I do stand by the thing that, you know, charities get a raw deal if they advertise and market. And we all know that marketing is about many things, isn't it? You have to raise awareness of your product in a commercial world before you ever make any revenue back off it. And I think it was time and money very well spent at Chelsea, and it was always going to a little bit split opinion at Chelsea. I think it's been a while since there was a big piece of graffiti on a wall at Chelsea, and the garden required a level of discussion or interpretation to fully understand it. And what the charity does is all about art, and the garden was all about art, and it was designed very much to be in your face, to be loud, bold and brash, and made no apologies for that.
It was interesting, actually, because Laura Anstis was designed with you, and she and it was this huge piece of colour in the middle of the Ranley Gardens there, and it was just like really attracted people, and I like to stand back and listen to what people are saying, you know, we all think we've got to be all fashionable and sit and, you know, all agree to the same things, and designers do that and things, but actually it's just really interesting at Chelsea this year when you did that garden to listen to what the visitors were saying, and they just loved it because people react to colour.
They did. That's absolutely right. And I think it was, we had some huge, very, very positive feedback, both for the garden designer and for being brave enough to bring that sort of design, you know, to Chelsea. We had some help for some very famous people, as you know, Andrew. And it was good to see, and it invoked thought, which is what we really wanted, and we wanted people to walk away and get it, you know, to get it, and you know, you don't have to, you know, what we do as a charity is very simple, but it makes a huge difference. And Sarah and I have always been about paying it forward, you know, about trying to do little things, lots of little things that will hopefully eventually add up to make a difference and to do one big thing. And that's what it did. It got people stopping and thinking about what they could do, how they could do something. And lots of people went away learning about childhood cancer. And that's what it's about.
Ken, I want to just ask you briefly. I've spoke in the past, and in part because of what I do for a living, probably similar to you, there's a bit where you sing from the heart, which doesn't earn you money, but it makes you smile, or at certain points of time, it might make other people weep. There's also the real job there, but I'm privileged that I get to speak to show managers, to charities who are saying, listen, we heard that interview with, for example, Naomi Ferrett-Cohen when she worked with Cherub. We want to get involved with a show, but we don't know how to do that. And on one hand, they'll split that for me and say, well, there are people like Graham Bodle who does things a little bit different. There are, again, the Naomi Ferrett-Cohens of this world who are new and first-timers at Chelsea, and it's uncharted waters, shall I phrase it that, or else they can go, as I chatted with Graham, and choose, let's say, the Tuscany-style garden so that the press release says, well, we got gold.
Yes.
In my head, at Chelsea, you didn't aim for gold. You aimed to make a big, bold, brash statement, but you did what was right for Super Shoes, which I absolutely loved because it was entirely different. But I can see the MD marketing person's point of view in all of this. How and what, for those listening at home to this who are involved in charities or maybe thinking about doing this, what's your advice to them?
Well, with my charitable hat on, the approach that we took was absolutely correct. With my landscaper hat on and Laura B. Anastas being the designer, I'm sure she would have liked a better result. She absolutely nailed the brief for the charity, and for my guys, they would have liked, who built the job, they would have liked a better medal. I would say to a charity that does that, it's about getting the message across in a way that sits with your ethos and your strategy. And what we did sat with our ethos and our strategy, and we knew it was never going to, you know, it was never going to be best in show or anything like that, but it was true to who we are. So to anybody else that's going to do it, I would say there's that position of getting your message out there, but be true to who you are. That would be my advice.
A couple of weeks ago, months ago at this stage of the game, there was a television show called The Apprentice. Some of you may be aware of it. To say the least, Ken, you were a little bit, kind of call it vocal.
Yeah, I was vocal. Vocal on Twitter. I realize that it's meant to be television, you know, and it's meant to be entertaining. But I just feel that it would be equally as entertaining to show these people how exciting and a wonderful career there is to be had in landscaping. I mean, it started with an absolute exemplar of what our industry does on the at the King's Cross there, Crosswell project, and then moved on to somebody painting a wooden bench with bright yellow paint, sticking a few pots down a step, and then they have the audacity to sort of say at the end of it, well, you charged the client £1,500 and your costs were £245, so you make £1,300 profit. So what kind of light does that show us and our industry in? And I think, you know, even Sugar's figures at the beginning, at the size of the industry, I think he said 5 billion, I think, but twice that, aren't we? You know, 11 billion pound industry. Sometimes I just think that these things don't do us any favours. And with a little bit of collaboration with either associations or a little bit of research, it could do wonders for our industry. I mean, people benefit from our landscapes every single day of their life, don't they? Walking around whatever city they live in, or in the gardens, or in the parks, and then we show it as a whole load of idiots who can't put a bloody hose on a tap. sorry, excuse my French, hose on the tap to make the jet wash work. I mean, what's that all about?
Well, it's a bit of lazy journalism, isn't it? It's like some researchers said, yeah. Oh, we're going to do a garden thing. So they popped into the shop and bought some garden magazines. I won't name any in particular. And they thought, well, we'll do it that way.
Yeah, those guys weren't landscapers either. So, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? I love what we do. And I just get frustrated when it's portrayed in the manner in which it was portrayed on the programme.
Well, the one thing myself and Andrew said was we should get out of garden design and go into pot supplying and step supplying and maybe rebrand our business cards, Ken. But I'll tell you what it did do, Ken, and it's up there with a name that's referenced now and again, but some of the things that Graham would do, some of the things that Helen and James would do. It created a conversation and it created a dialogue. It wasn't the way in which I would have preferred it to do, but then I've never heard pots and hose pipes and people doing maintenance and people pricing things incorrectly. And the suggestion that I can buy £250 worth of anything and make £1,200 or £1,300 in the space of a day is slight lunacy, but it did create a bit of a dialogue. And maybe I raised the question in saying this, maybe that's something we need a little bit more of.
It's interesting, actually.
Yeah,
sorry, go on, Ken, you go.
No, you carry on, Andrew.
All right. Oh, we've been polite here. I always loved with Ground Force how designers used to complain about it. But actually, it was sort of, it was landscaping, it was design done in an accessible way. And people who knew it knew that it wasn't costing £1,500 because they could see that there was a lot of free labour involved and things like that. But actually, it stimulated that conversation. I always thought, you know, when I started out and Ground Force was on, it actually did a lot for my business. And just because you don't like the design doesn't mean to say that, you know, it's a bad thing for a business, because they actually did it in a reasonably sort of professional way. The Apprentice is a different thing altogether.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. And I probably, we talked about one of my passions earlier being whiskey, and perhaps if I'd had less of those, I might not have been so vocal on the evening. But I have to take on board, I think there's some very fair points raised by both of you, that there was a conversation stimulated, and it is entertaining. It's just sometimes... I guess I reach a flashpoint, and that's just my personality. And then that particular evening, I reached a flashpoint with what I was watching on the telly. I've also been involved with Love Your Garden as well when it was on, and there was the same sort of love and hate relationship with that as to whether it was doing the industry any good or not doing it any good. And my personal opinion was that it was. But ultimately, at the end of the day, with Love Your Garden, it's a feel-good program, but it gave out some interesting advice, and I know that certainly myself and my guys thoroughly enjoyed our time working with the team from Love Your Garden. But there's some people who are perhaps not such a fan of it, so maybe I'm being hypocritical.
I think Ken probably also Love Your Garden. It turns people onto the idea of having a great garden. Now, whether they do it themselves or they employ like someone like yourself, that doesn't matter in a way. It, at least it turns people onto the idea of gardening, and that's a good thing in itself.
I'll summarise it for you this way, Ken. As an Arsenal fan, I'm allowed to weep on a regular basis watching them play, at least last season anyway. I'm allowed to weep and I'm allowed to cry, and I am allowed to be disappointed and be heartbroken and have heartache, but I feel passionately about it as a guy who's done nothing else apart from things that photosynthesize since I've been 5 years of age. And if watching that TV program didn't upset you in any way because of what you do for a living and love, then I would suggest you're probably an android and there's a little bit of a chip missing from you. The fact that you spoke and the fact that a conversation came as a byproduct of that is probably Peter looking for a positive, which invariably I do. Yep. But yes, it was very easy to see that it was something a little bit different. Ken, I want to skew on past that just for a second. What you do, and we haven't spoke about this, so we should probably take this bit and put it at the end, but I won't do that. But what you do for a living is what, or what's your title and what's your role and how big is the thing that you're involved in?
Yeah, so I'm Managing Director for Frost Landscape Construction. And until very recently, it was a family-owned business with a heritage of knocking on 50 years. And it was connected to Frost Garden Centres, which has a heritage of about 80 years. We work predominantly in commercial landscaping rather than private domestic, although we do private domestic. So our company was heavily involved with Olympic Park, Jubilee Gardens, and we work mainly inside the City of London. Probably our speciality has been roof gardens, both intensive and extensive roof gardens. Honestly, it's no longer a family-owned business. Myself and two of the directors have purchased the business from the Frost family from August of this year. So I've been with the company, 14, 15 years? I've been MD for 6, but now I have a part share in the ownership of the business. So it's mainly commercial landscaping. We used to do grounds maintenance and interior, Christmas tree hire, all of that side, but now we focus on construction, either commercially or private domestic.
Can I ask you, Ken, when you see things, and I'm going to take this now back a step to where I didn't want to go back to, but when you see things like, I jest in saying this one, but The Apprentice anyway, and yep. Then you see things, let's say, for example, like a Cape Gold garden, for example, at Chelsea or a Fisher Tomlin and Bowyer garden in the north of France, and people ring you and say, hi, I'd like one of them. Do you turn around and say, on one hand, no, or two, but this is where the trend is heading, we need to take something out of this?
Well, both of all the designers you've mentioned, I've got an awful lot of time for. We used to do a lot of design, Peter, and I've changed it now. I'm not offering design, so that's one of the changes we've made in the market since we've taken it over, that I'm looking purely to be a construction company and leave those with a greater artistic flair than what we had to get on with the design. And what we're there to do is to offer a solid construction service to existing designers.
That's interesting, Ken, because a lot of the world out there is, you know, landscapers taking on designers and having design part. I know there's a Mr. Dodds out there once said yep. to me that he thought it was strange that designers were taking on landscapers, but basically there's a lot of design and build there. So why have you made that decision not to have the designers?
Well, because I think really, as I said, our market was pretty much largest part was in construction. You know, so at our height, we would be doing sort of 12, 13 million pounds worth of construction a year on commercial projects, and you know, one to 1.5 million on private domestic. And when you're into offering the design side on commercial projects, you're really into the world of landscape architecture rather than design. And what we're being asked to do was to take projects on from stage B in the design process all the way through to the end. And we're taking a long, hard look at it and questioned, you know, why are the landscape architects not doing that in the first instance, finishing the design themselves? And it's either one of a few reasons, you know, either the end client doesn't want to pay the landscape architect to complete the process because they either believe it's not cost effective, or that they think there's an awful lot of items that still need to be sorted out, and then it's left to the landscaper. We were kind of running towards the, like a moth to the flame, running towards it going, we'll sort this out. And there wasn't enough time really given in the projects to sort out the remaining issues with the design, and we just felt we were going nowhere fast. And then private domestic side, why do we drop the design on that? Let's be honest, if somebody's got the kind of money that I need, because we have a big company, we have a large overhead, so therefore I need fairly large private domestic projects. And if somebody's got £200,000 to spend on a private garden, which is a very nice private garden, they want somebody like you, Andrew. They don't want my designer. So we were finding that we were kind of stuck in the middle. So
I'm just thinking, oh, that would be nice, £200,000 garden.
Well, I was just thinking yeah. that he said you and not me, and that's now I feel like the ostrich in the room, Ken. But thanks for the high five, nonetheless.
But you know what I mean by that is that when they're, I mean, not necessarily on the design fees, but what they want to spend on it. So, and because we were connected to the garden centres, we very much had somebody that has been a garden centre client for 40 years or something, you know, an oldish lady, 40 years, who then wanted me to do 4 square meters of paving and put up some fencing. And then I would have to tell her, I can't compete at that because my overhead and my structure is not like that. Then they would get very upset. So, and I wasn't trying to damage the brand. So at the end of the day, the best thing really was to stick with what we know best, and that's to get on with construction and to let others who do the design get on with the design.
Ken, I just want to ask you briefly, I know Andrew's involved with London Culture Garden Design, so a lot of the conversation we've had over the last couple of days and weeks has been to do a little bit with the new wave of designers that are coming through. And partly what I was saying was, look, at 5-6 years of age, I was goofing around with plants down the back of the garden when I was 10, and I was doing my first one when I was 19, when I was 16, when I was going through college and out the far side. Essentially, it's all I've done, but I've built the brick walls, I've built the raised beds, I know how to use the tree anchoring systems. It's the tail can never wag the dog, if you understand me. So when I put a design together, I know how to explain it to the contractor, if that is and should be required, or I know what I'm about to put him through, is the other way of saying that. And what we were about talking about was the odd design that comes out from a designer who you've never really maybe heard of, but the edging of the borders is made out of Guatemalan quail eggs and shaved duck feathers, and it's, you know, being rubbed with tea tree oil 3 times on a Sunday, and you're looking at this as a quantity surveyor ahead, and you're saying, I can't, this is going to take me 420 years to even put this cost together. Have you come through that? Yep. How do you deal with that, and how are you seeing those new wave of designers?
Yeah, we have come through that, and that is without a doubt, you know, one of the biggest problems that we have. So I think, you know, from a designer contractor point of view, it's all about building that relationship and trying to get that to go further forward. And there's, you know, you mentioned earlier I was with the APL, I was the past chair for the APL, and the other associations, SGD, Bali, and the guys, you know, particularly if I talk for the APL, which I was more heavily involved in, we're now carrying out cluster meetings where we're putting designers and contractors together so they can both start to see the points and the issues from each other's side so that they can help each other collaboratively to move forward. If you're a new designer, it's very difficult to meet a contractor. And if you're a contractor, how do you find these new designers? So it was a kind of education. Well, APL's not alone in doing that. But, the quantity surveying is a skill in itself, isn't it? So you need the drawings from the people and the descriptions that come with the drawings or the specification to be have enough information to allow a contractor to be able to price it. Quite often we'll see, you know, a brick wall that's on it. And we'll say, well, you know, is this a brick thick? Is it a half foot thick? Has it got ties on it? How tall do you want it? What bond do you want it? And what tends to happen with that I'm seeing with the garden design side of things is it doesn't come with a specification. When you have a commercial project, you know, we have standard specifications, you know, Q35, Q28, Q-whatever, all tied back to British standards that we all know what we're pricing and we all know what the method of measurement is. But that's lacking. Very much on the private domestic side of things. So it's just education, isn't it? It's education, but it does make it hard for people to get a true price. And where a designer or their client is looking for comparable prices, it makes it very difficult to get to measure apples with apples, isn't it? Because there's too much interpretation. So I would urge the design side to have more of a specification with their drawings so that the contractor could price what they're looking for.
I think what we need to do is get Ken back on the show, and we'll get into this one in a little bit more detail. Probably a nice way to end it off, so that in about a year's time I could say you might remember a little bit, go back and listen to it. In the meantime, Ken White is the MD of Frost Landscapes. Andrew Fisher-Tomlin is sitting to my left-hand side to listen at home. Thank you so much. It really does mean a lot. And without London College of Gardens and Andrew to my left, this interview wouldn't be happening. Ken, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you both, gentlemen. Thanks so much. Take care.
Chat soon. Bye-bye.